All right, good morning, everybody. My name is Seth. I'm one of the pastors here on staff. I get to teach this text. This is a lot of a text. It's heavy. Doesn't pull any punches. We're looking straight down the barrel at some of the most intense things that humans have to deal with. This book of Genesis is actually on the exhausting side. It feels like every other week, every other story is another severe, sobering story about humans ruining their lives and the lives of the people all around them. Just for a frame of reference, this week we're talking about Hagar and Ishmael. Next week, we're talking about Sodom and Gomorrah, not getting any lighter. The week after that, we're talking about God's command, Happy Cinco de Mayo, that Isaac is to be sacrificed. So just do with that information what you want. That's where we're going the next few weeks. But I feel like coming to this text, so I have these dog named Calvin, who we used to like a lot, and we had kids. Now he's around, and we kind of call him Dyson because he just cleans up the mess that my two-year-old makes. You know, he helps pick up the stuff. More of a Roomba, you know, he kind of self-driving, you know. But he's nice when he's not noticed. But we just had these mushrooms start growing in our backyard for whatever reason. And this is what happens. As dog eats mushrooms, dog vomits. And you would like to think the dog would kind of do cause effect and stop eating the mushrooms. But that's too much to ask. The dog is a psycho and he keeps eating the mushrooms. And so there's like this daily discovery of where did the dog vomit today in our house. So there's piles over here one day, there's stain on our cloth couch the next day, and there's this like, you live here, dog. You know, can you stop vomiting in your own house? Like this is, at least vomit outside. I locked him outside for a whole day so he'd vomit outside. The next day, guess what? He's like, I'm going to vomit inside. You know, and so it's just this perpetual self-defeating behavior. And I read the story of Abraham, and I feel the same way. Abraham, can you, for like 5 minutes, stop vomiting in your own house? Can you just stop the self-destructive, sinful behavior that's so glaringly obvious, that's causing you pain and the people around you pain? And it's just like Abram's like, nope, I'm going to keep doing it. And it's just, it's exhausting to watch this happen. But this is what's wild about this story in particular, is this story, this is our life. This is not just a fairy tale somewhere else. This is how the lives of people work. There are these characters in the story, Abram and Sarai, who cause tremendous pain with their sin. These other characters in the story, Ishmael and Hagar, who are on the receiving end of tons of pain because of other people's sin. And it is just difficult to look at. It's difficult to stomach. And it's erasing and removing the shiny silver lining that is the kind of positive spin on life. It is just tough. And when I say that it's a lot, here's what I mean is we're going to look at Genesis 16, which is the story of how Ishmael's conceived and how that unfolds. And we're going to also get Genesis 21, when eventually Abram kicks Hagar and Ishmael out of his house and sends them into the wilderness. And so there are weighty themes in this text. And here's what I want us to do as we try to look at this text is, one, I want us to understand that I actually, as far as I can tell, 99% of people in this room will connect with Hagar and Ishmael in some very serious way. This is not a light subject. So you will have to think about and be confronted by some of the wounds in your past. And if you haven't done that or processed that, this will be a hard Sunday. The other thing I want to do is not just look through the lens personally, but also experience this story, understanding, and maybe even just assuming the way that other people in this room experience this text and the way it's severe and deals with the severity of life. And so listen with personal ears, but also with the ears of love as we try to look at this. So here are the themes that we see in this text. I just want you to know where we're going, what this is going to deal with. And so infertility. You can click through these a little faster. Sin as pain reliever, generational trauma, power and consent, unwanted pregnancy, fatherly abandonment, single motherhood, male passivity, female insecurity. No, every single one of these is a lot, and every single one of these is in the text. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the story, we're going to read the story together, and then I'm going to reflect on the story. But as we do it, I want us to understand here that we are like Abram and Sarai, and at the same time, we're like Hagar and Ishmael in terms of the lives that we live. So let's start in Genesis 16, and I'm going to work through this. So you're going to want to follow along with me. I'm going to read a lot of this. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar, and Sarai said to Abram, "Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go to my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. So a couple of things in this first part of the story. One, Sarah and Abram have been trying for 10 years to have a child after God had promised they would have a child. They had been trying, God promised you'll have a child, and now it's been 10 more years. That's 10 years of every month, severe disappointment. Is God good? But God said, I don't know how many more times I can take this severe disappointment. That is a long time to go on being disappointed by God. This text nowhere seeks to minimize or make light of this form of suffering. Unfulfilled promise, unfulfilled desire, unfulfilled holy desire. And yet, Sarah and Abram, then, in the context of their suffering, they actually reenact the story of Genesis 3. Genesis 3, right? Eve takes the fruit and gives it to her husband who is with her, and he eats also. Here, Sarah takes Hagar, gives her to the husband who is passive in there with her. All it would have taken is Abram to say no. All it would have taken is Sarah to not do this. But what she's doing is she is treating Hagar like she was treated. We're made in God's image. We tend to enact what was enacted on us. A couple stories ago, there's a famine in the land. Abram and Sarah go down to Egypt. Abram pimps out his wife, uses her sexuality for his own benefit. Now here you have Sarah doing to Hagar what Abram did to her. Using Hagar's sexuality for her own benefit. Hagar doesn't get a say. Hagar doesn't have the capacity to give consent. Hagar's presumed on. Abram's passive. Sarah's mad at God. God's preventing me from having a child. Therefore, she's going to take matter into her own hands. Hagar conceives, verse 4. And when she saw that she conceived, she looked at contempt with her mistress. Hagar's not stupid. She understands my mistress is going to be very jealous. Because the infertility question is it Abram's problem? Is it Sarai's problem? Clearly, Abraham had what it take to father a child. Now Sarah's mad. Her own insecurity flares up. Now Hagar knows what's going to go. Sarah then turns to Abram and says, "The wrong that's been done to me is on you." She's now reenacting the sin of Adam, that woman you gave me. Sarai saying, that woman I gave you, the wrong that's been done to me, it's your fault. I gave her to you, and then she looked at me with contempt, made the Lord judge between you and me. Abraham, the conflict avoider, says, behold, she's in your power, do to her what you want. So Sarah abuses her, deals harshly with her, and Hagar flees. These are the people through whom God is going to bless the world. You'd think, how is Hagar experiencing this? Abraham says, God's going to bless me, I'm going to be a blessing. lots of kids, blah, 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 blah. And it's through that guy that she's being, having her rights taken. She's being presumed on. Now, a lot of commentators say, hey, this was socially acceptable in that time period. And I want you to know, I do not care at all what counts as socially acceptable. I care about what is right and wrong. I don't even want to begin to imagine what will be socially acceptable here in 50 years, or in 100 years, or in 500 years. And the fact that something is socially acceptable then does not even come close to the fact that it violates Genesis 1 and 2 far and away. Social acceptability is not the standard of right and wrong. The fact that it was normal for slaves to be treated this way, for servants to be treated this way, I do not care. Wrong is wrong. Whatever culture says. Then Hagar flees. She runs out. Verse 7 says, the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water. This woman is pregnant with Abraham's son. What's he doing? Nothing. Hanging out. God goes and finds her by a spring. If you're familiar with the New Testament, in John 4, there's the Jesus at the woman of the well. This is kind of like the first, there's a woman who's been mistreated by a well, and the Lord goes and finds her. He says, where are you going? Go back to your mistress. In verse 10 says, the angel of the Lord says to her, I will multiply your offspring so they cannot be numbered in multitude. That in the middle of Hagar being misused, mistreated, God speaks up, pronounces blessing, says, I will bless you so that the number cannot even be numbered. Says, you're pregnant and you'll be a son, and his name will be Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. Sarah hasn't listened, Abram hasn't listened, but God hears. Ishmael means God hears. The Lord hears the affliction. It says, he will be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, and he shall dwell against his kinsmen. There's a lot of Israel-Palestine in the news all the time. And if they had news 3,000 years ago, it'd be in the news all the time. If they had news 1,000 years ago, it'd be in the news all the time. And there's a time and a place to argue about the geopolitical solutions, but I see Genesis 16:12. That from Ishmael come the Arabs, and from Isaac come the Jews. And verse 12 says, he'll be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, everyone's hand against him. He shall dwell over and against all his kinsmen. People ask from time to time, why do Christians care about sexual ethics so much? What's the big deal? This is the big deal. Is that Abram's sexual impropriety leads to the chaos in the Middle East that's gone for 4,000 years. Is that sex outside of God's design truly causes suffering and destruction and decay. It's not just about being the moral police, arbitrary right and wrong, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, that behavior's in, that behavior's out. It says, look at the consequence. Look at who it hurts the most. Abram's not wounded. Sarah's not wounded. Hagar's wounded. The generational ripple effects of this chaos, of this war. Millions and millions of lives. And whose fault is it? Or where did it come from? Where did it stem from? Abraham goes into Hagar after Sarah told him it was a good idea. Hagar calls out, alone in the wilderness except for the Lord, you are a God of seeing. For she said, truly, here I have seen him who looks after me. You know, the church isn't great at seeing women like Hagar. Jump with me to Genesis 21. The plot unfolds. Sarah eventually does get pregnant with Isaac. Now you have Ishmael, who's about 15 years old or so, and his half-brother is weaned, so he's probably 2 or 3 years old. It's kind of like a birthday party equivalent. And, you know, I've been to a lot of 2 to 3 year old birthday parties. You know who they're not interesting to is 15-year-olds. You know how I know that? Because they're not interesting to anybody. That's why. You know who's not great at regulating their disappointment and their boredom? 15-year-olds. Do you know why? Because they're just genuinely more honest than other people are. So Isaac's having this little congratulations, you're not being breastfed anymore party. And Ishmael, who's like a normal 15-year-old kid, thinks this party stinks, and he's mocking or laughing. Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne, Abraham, mocking. So she says to Abraham, cast out that slave woman and her son, for the son of that slave woman will not be heir with my son Isaac. This is Sarah's same insecurity that made her lash out at Hagar the first time. Now it's lashing out at a teenager. This is like just a good word, is if you find yourself lashing out at a teenager who's being immature, you are the problem because you have the more capacity to be the adult, okay? So Sarah lashes out, get him out of here. Abram, the chronic under-interventioner, because like, I don't know, and then he goes to God and God says, what she set her mind on doing, let her do it. Now you got to understand here, Abraham is wealthy, like big W wealthy. Lots of cash, donkeys. He's got means. So when God says, send him out, it'll be okay. Abraham is told he'll make a nation out of that slave woman. So there'll be a big nation there. So here's what Abraham's option is. So verse 14, Abraham rose early in the morning and took bread and a water bottle and gave it to Hagar, put it on her shoulder along with the child, and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness. So God had said, okay, if Sarah is committed to not doing this thing, like maybe have a separate cat, Abram could have sent like 15 donkeys and some help, and but he sends it with a water bottle and a loaf of bread and says, good luck. His son, his 15-year-old son. Verse 15, now when the water in the skin was gone, she put the water under one of the bushes. Then she went and sat down opposite him a good way off, about the distance of a bow shot. For she said, let me not look on the death of the child. As she sat opposite to him, she lifted up her voice and wept. Now Hagar was a little girl once with aspirations and hopes and dreams. Do you think she thought when she was like 13, one day I'm going to grow up and be a single mom, fending for myself in the wilderness, having to teach my son how to use a bow because his dad just sent us out with a loaf of bread and a skin of water and said, good luck? Do you think Ishmael, when he's 9, friends with his dad's in the community, he's going to think, I can't wait to go through the second half of puberty without my father in the house? All the time, we end up where we didn't plan on being there. All the time, we find ourselves in the situations that are not our fault. And someone else put us there. And who knows, if you saw Hagar in the wilderness with her kid, what you would think about her. You might think, what kind of irresponsible woman raises her child out here like this? You might think, what did she do to burn the bridge with her, with this boy's dad? You might think, what kind of trouble did he cause that led to this situation? You might fill in the blanks all types of ways, thinking you know what's going on with Hagar and Ishmael, and you don't. She lifted her voice and wept, verse 17, and God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of the Lord called from God, from heaven, and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the boy. God still hears. Up, lift up the boy, hold him fast in your hand, for I will make him into a great nation. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. And God was with the boy, and he grew. God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert in the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him in the land of Egypt. This single mom grinds it out, finds a way. God's in the midst of this, pronouncing blessing on Ishmael, despite his dad and his stepmom causing all this strain. And you can imagine the difficulty for Hagar and Ishmael, being disregarded, unwanted, used, tossed. But one of the things that I think would be even more disorienting and wild is the fact that in the middle of this story, God is still blessing Abram and Sarah, the perpetrators, the ones sinning and causing suffering. Genesis 17, right after Abram goes into Hagar, Genesis 17, God is changing his name from Abram to Abraham because he'd be a father of many nations. Chapter 17, verse 9 says, "And God said to Abram, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you through generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised." That, like God makes a promise to Noah and he gives him a rainbow, a sign of the covenant. Like we take marriage vows and we wear a ring, sign of the covenant. Here, God promises to bless Abram that he cut the animals in half and said, if I break my covenant, be like these animals. But now, as a sign of that covenant, circumcision. Now there's two elements going on in this sign we need to understand, because it feels kind of arbitrary and wild. If you know, we're generally familiar with the idea of circumcision, but you can imagine that Abram gets told, circumcise all the men, and then he has to come back to like the group. All right, guys, we got to do something. They're like, what is it? He's like, circumcision. And they're like, yeah, pass. Ishmael's 13 at the time. It's a hard sell. Like, what's the deal with this? So I'm going to give you a semi-nerdy overview of circumcision and then a semi-less nerdy application of it, all right? So first of all, in Egypt, the neighbors to this group down south and to the west, all of the elite priests got circumcised. It was a picture of being committed to the gods from an intimate place as a signal of elite access to God. So then you go to Abraham's community, and all the men can get circumcised now as a picture of it's not just like the elite who have access to the gods, but it's every household has a priest, because God's making a kingdom of priests. Priests are the person who intercede, like speak to people on behalf of God. Now, every household has this access to God. But then even within that, it's meant to be this picture of commitment to God from the intimate place, but it's pointing past itself to being circumcised of the heart from the internal seat of commitment. Not just being physically, but being volitionally and emotionally committed to God from the heart. Here's what it says in Deuteronomy 30, that even in the Old Testament, circumcision looks past itself. The Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and that you may live. Now God circumcises hearts, but people can circumcise themselves. And so there's like this work of God coming, and it's pointing past itself to the eventual pouring out of the Spirit in Acts chapter 2 after the resurrection of Christ, when the Spirit comes and all and people's hearts get circumcised. And so for Christians, the command to circumcise no longer applies, because it points past itself to circumcision of the heart, which a picture of circumcision of the heart is baptism. So for us, baptism follows circumcision of the heart, which is faith in Christ, which has replaced the Old Testament view of circumcision. So we hear about circumcision, about being committed to the Lord from your heart in baptism. But more than that, you got to understand here the arc of the story. So Genesis 16, Abram goes into Hagar. The next point of the story is Abraham needs to circumcise the thing that caused the pain in the previous story. The next story is Sodom and Gomorrah. That you have sexual impropriety, sexual deviancy, and right in the middle, you need to be committed to God from your most intimate space. intimate place. That this picture of possible pain inflicted, we got to understand here how big of a deal sexual ethics are, that the very picture of the sign of the covenant is one that I'm going to be committed to God from the most expression of intimate thing that I have. You cannot separate the flow of the story from even the sign of the covenant. The pain we inflict on each other, the pain we inflict on our spouses, the pain we inflict on our children, the pain our society inflicts on us, that you cannot look at the brokenness of sexuality and not at the same time see the suffering that sin creates. And yet, that very sign is given to Abram. Despite that, what he just did, God's going to uphold his covenant. Remember, God walks through the cut carcasses by himself. Remember that God points the bow of Noah at himself. Remember that Christ dies on the cross by himself. Still, God is blessing Abram. And I got to understand here, that would be incredibly painful for Hagar and Ishmael to witness. How long does Harvey Weinstein get to keep doing his thing? How long does Epstein Island open? How long will those with power continue to abuse and get away with it? How long can Abram keep vomiting his own house and God keeps blessing him? We got to have space in our hearts for how painful it is for people who have been seriously sinned against to see the perpetrators receive grace. Like, that takes a long time to stomach that. And I think that's okay. And we can relativize it. Obviously, Ishmael's a sinner too. Hagar's a sinner too. Everybody's broken. Everyone needs grace. Blah, blah, blah. Abram's sin was worse. All sin's equally damning. It's not all equally damaging. So, that story's brutal. That story's our story. Here are some takeaways I have for us. One, wounds you don't repair, you'll redistribute. Abram sins against Sarah, pimping her out to Pharaoh. Then Sarai reenacts her trauma on Hagar and uses her for her own benefit. This is generational sin. This is the way that we're made in God's image. We're supposed to experience and then reenact. That's part of being an image bearer. And when we're sinned against, we tend to sin against others like we've been sinned against. And understand this. What happened to Sarah was wrong in Egypt. And what happened to Hagar through Sarah was wrong. We got to understand this as adults, that whatever was done to you is not your fault, but your passing it on to your kids or your neighbors or your friends is your fault. We live in this moment, hyper-emphasized on therapy, where people want to say, like, no, why did I do that? Oh, maybe it was my childhood wound. And I want to say, there might be Sarah learned this behavior in Egypt, but guess what? Hagar doesn't care where Sarah learned this behavior. Hagar's just receiving the suffering of Sarah's failures. Sarah's sin in this situation is wrong, and it's inexcusable. And we have to take responsibility that what happened to me is my responsibility to repair it and to work through it and process it and not redistribute it. This next point is related, that sin or suffering never justifies sin, but it can be its greenhouse. Asking the question, where did I learn this behavior, is a good question, but it never justifies my sinning. That Sarai and Abram have been trying to have a kid for decades, and that's real suffering, and the Bible does not try to minimize that suffering, but then seeking to alleviate that suffering through sinning is unacceptable. Why? Because it causes suffering. Sin is not arbitrary. Suffering is like a jacuzzi. The higher the temperature, the more the bacteria, the more chlorine you need. That it is understandable and we can empathize that often suffering begets sin, but it never excuses and never justifies. Number three, there's no such thing as an unseen, unwanted child. No such thing as an unseen or unwanted child. Some of you identify with Hagar in the story, and that's brutal. Some of you identify with Ishmael in the story, also brutal. Kicked out, disowned, abdicated. The Lord hears Ishmael. Abram doesn't hear Ishmael. The Lord sees Ishmael. Abram doesn't see Ishmael. Yet God sees this boy. He hears the boy. He says, I'll make you a great nation. A lot of you have been doing a lot of work, working through childhood wounds, feeling unwanted or being unwanted by parents, step-parents, guardians, peers. And that's a lot of work. It's difficult. That no matter how unwanted you might have been on earth, there is a creator, an author, the Father in heaven, the Lord Most High, the all-seeing, all-knowing one, who wants and desires and sees every child. There's a bill that's probably going to be on the ballot in November that will likely, it'll almost certainly be on the ballot, but this bill makes abortion legal up until 40 weeks. We did this thing back in December called the Best Friend Grants, and there's six winners. So people gave money, people applied for these grants. How can we be the best friend to our community? And there are a handful of winners, and two of them I want to tell you about right now. All of them are on our website. If you go to our blog, you can check that out. See the six winners, contact people who are running the initiatives. But two of them I want to highlight. One is a friend of mine who I've known for a long time named Gabby. She's a therapist, and she wanted to start this group and help fund this group that really focuses on helping women heal from reproductive trauma, which includes infertility and miscarriage and past abortion. So Gabby's doing that. The other one is this group called Loving the Unborn in Arizona, run by someone from our church named Aaron, who won a grant. And it's really focusing on how we're going to educate and work against abortion being legalized to 40 weeks in Arizona this coming November. So Aaron's a member of this church. If you'd like to be involved in helping engage with some of that stuff, you can scan that QR code. There'll also be a copy of it at the info desk on your way back. But the people of God say and believe with clear conscience, there is no such thing as an unseen or unwanted child. Next one, God's silence is not God's approval. The next one is that God blesses us in spite of our father's sin. Imagine Ishmael wandering in the wilderness, going, if I had just not laughed, if I had just not mocked, if I had just done the right thing, then my insecure mother-in-law wouldn't have kicked me out. This temptation to over-responsibility is normal, especially in children. Somehow it's my fault. It's not Ishmael's fault. It's not Hagar's fault. It's Sarai's fault. It's Abram's fault. And yet, God doesn't withhold blessing for Ishmael because of what his parents did, or his father and his stepmom. I will make you a great nation. Whatever cards you've inherited from your parents, God still will bless and work through you. You can be the one who breaks the cycle. You can be the one who breaks the cycle of generational trauma. You can be the one who stops repeating the sin that's happened to you. And last, God is not a God of second chances. I hate that phrase. God's a God of second chances. And here's why. Because Abraham's already on his third chance. Second chances are something a nice boss gives you at work. Do better or you're fired. God's not giving second chances. He's giving grace, which is way better. Second chances is like, I messed up that time. This time, I'll do better. And it kind of presents salvation as this team sport. But guess what? Salvation is not a team sport. I've been coaching these 4 and 6 year old basketball kids, you know. We were 2-0, and then yesterday we lost. And I was more devastated than everybody else. But here's why we lost, all right? We got these two kids on our team, next Kobe and the next Yao Ming. Like, they're good, you know. But the sportsmanship value of the week was teamwork. And so I taught them, teamwork is passing the ball. Teamwork is sharing the ball. And guess who passed the ball way too much? Kobe and Yao. All these other kids are taking shots. We lost, all right? I should have told those kids, hey, teamwork for you means they pass you the ball and you shoot the ball. This is what salvation is like. We can, like, contribute nothing. We just steal the ball from our own teammates, vomit at our own house, cry we don't get the ball, can't pick the ball up, knock it out of bounds. We are self-destroying. We're self-destructive behavior teammates. And yet here's God saving the day all by himself. And that is the good news of salvation, is that for the ways that we are like Abram and Sarah, this is not a team sport. And for the ways that we are like Hagar and Ishmael, God sees and he cares. So we're going to end our time, and it's going to do a little different. Before we jump to communion, in the communion space, we reflect on how we're like Sarah and Abraham. How do we need forgiveness from God? But I want to give us a minute or two just to be quiet before the Lord and reflect on the ways that we are like Hagar and Ishmael, to take our suffering to the Lord. That I want everyone in this room to be able to pray with Hagar, chapter 16, verse 13, truly here at the 11:30 service at Redemption Ironwood, at Ironwood Church, sorry. Here at Ironwood Church at the 11:30 service, I have seen him who looks after me. I want you to be able to pray that right now. That specifically, the ways that you've been like Hagar and Ishmael, I want to take that to him. So let me pray, and then you're going to have 2 minutes to do that before John comes up and leads communion. Holy Spirit, guide our minds, guard our hearts. God, for the weighty and severe ways that we are like Hagar and Ishmael, help us feel seen by you in the middle of this. In this quietness, I pray that your Spirit would assure us and help us feel seen. Amen.